That video frames the wonderful contrast of hope coming out of despair. And the event that we are remembering today is at the center of that contrast. Hope is essential to our well-being. It looks to a brighter future. It gives us a reason for living. Hope gets you out of bed in the morning. It fuels your work, your play, your relationships. It gives significance to the decisions that we make and the things that we think into. Hope sustains us in hard times because we see a light at the end of the tunnel, and it doesn't matter how far away it is, we just keep moving towards it. Yeah. Well, tonight, as has been mentioned, is an opportunity for us to consider, what are our hopes? What is it that gets you out of bed in the morning? What fuels you? And I want to ask, how solid is your hope? How certain are you that it will not disappoint, that it will deliver? We've called Easter, these celebrations, solid hope, because the events of Jesus 2,000 years ago are all about hope. But they're about a particular kind of hope, a solid one that delivers, not a shaky one that disappoints and diminishes us. So as I look around our community, I see people putting their hope, that kind of reason for living hope, in a whole bunch of things. I see people putting it in their bodies, finely chiseled and tanned specimen kind of bodies. Anyone into the CrossFit thing, latest craze? I was in hospital a few weeks ago and in the emergency room, and next door to me behind the curtain was this woman who I thought was giving birth. She was in that much pain. And I said, "What's up?" And she said, "CrossFit. I had my first session of CrossFit today." And she'd busted something and she was screaming and moaning. And I thought, that's enough of a reason for me to never go near that thing. I'm quite happy to stay like this. We put a lot of hope in how we look. I see people hanging their hopes in relationships. It's the big one, yeah? Because we're wired for them. Yet inevitably, those hopes are disappointed, either because of betrayal or at least with enough time, death and separation. I see people hanging their hopes in their job, their career paths, only to find one day a younger generation rise up and replace them. I see people hoping in their wealth, despite all the evidence around us that says it's not going to work, it's not going to give us the happiness we're after, it's not going to keep away sickness, and it definitely cannot keep away that great enemy of death. You know, as I look around our community, I see people whose hope has become so small, so that the biggest thing they're living for is Friday night and the high that they're going to come to. Picking themselves off the floor, doing it again Saturday night, and then somehow just getting through the week, thinking about repeating it all over again. And you know, when our hopes diminish, we diminish as people. We diminish as a community. We become increasingly shallow and self-centered. And our hopes actually only ever give way to despair. And so I say this not to view life as a party pooper, but because I want to put to you that there's only two kinds of hopes. One that will eventually, given enough time, disappoint and diminish. It's going to end when our lives end. But there's another kind of hope, and it's a hope that guarantees not to disappoint, a hope not to fade over time, and a hope that will actually go beyond the grave. This is the kind of hope that I want to talk about. Now, the certainty of this hope isn't wishful thinking or blind faith. The certainty of this hope is to look to the character and the actions of the God who offers it. And so tonight I want to do that with you. I want to look at just a few of Jesus' words really striking words, and consider the hope that is there. But before we get to them, let me give you two more observations about hope. The first one is that the Bible is all about hope. That's at the heart of the message of Jesus, and it speaks of it frequently. But it uses the word hope in a different way to us. See, the Bible understands hope as a confident expectation that something good will happen. Something that hasn't happened yet, but is so certain we can almost speak of it as being ours now. Reminds me of my little 4-year-old daughter, Tiffany. Every birthday, Christmas, she's just got a knack of finding where we hide the presents, yeah? And so it's not that hard, it's under the bed every time. But she finds the present and she gets stoked out of her brain. She's like, what was the latest one? A head dolly, where she's practicing plaiting and all that kind of stuff and showing me up. She saw this head dolly, she got so excited. She started speaking about this head dolly as though it's there, as though it was hers, knowing that she actually had a bit of time before it came. That's a Bible kind of hope that my daughter has in her presence. But when we speak of hope, generally we're speaking about something that we're really uncertain of, yeah? We speak of, I hope it's not going to rain this weekend. Or maybe more significant things. I hope to find that special someone. I hope to be married. Our hope looks ahead to the future, but we're not at all certain that it's going to happen. It's like whenever we talk about hoping for something, we put a big question mark at the end of it, as though we're preparing ourselves for frustration or disappointment. And so the Bible's understanding of hope is good news for people who cannot see the future. But a second observation about our hopes is that they reveal our fears. They reveal our fears. See, if you hope greatly to meet someone and to be married, it reveals a fear of staying alone, loneliness. You hope to lose weight, reveals a fear of flab and image and bad health, all that kind of stuff. Sometimes we even hope against things, yeah? I really don't want to be like that. You hope not to, I hope, ladies, be like Kim Kardashian, yeah? Like, famous for being divorced twice before she's 30 and only outdoing Paris Hilton. You're like, no, I hope not to be anything like that. Now, some of these hopes and fears are actually good ones, but it's possible to get our fears out of perspective. And so getting our fears out of perspective, we then get our hopes out of perspective too. But the event that we're remembering today, the death of Jesus, brings perspective to our fears and our hopes. It shows us what ought to be our greatest fear and therefore what our greatest hope should be. And so to get this perspective, to understand this hope, I want to take you to the dying words of Jesus, which I know sounds like a pretty strange place to go to find hope. But let's do that. Let's have a look at them. Now, if you've got a Bible, Psalm 22, if you don't, that's cool. We've got those sheets of paper there. Follow along with me so that you can see what I'm talking about. The first thing we'll look at are Jesus' dying words, which is Matthew 27, which is one of the eyewitness accounts that we have of Jesus' life and death. And we read there, chapter 27, 46, Jesus crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, they sound like horrifying words, don't they? They seem like hopeless words. But I want to show you that it's out of these seemingly hopeless words that we find our greatest hope. And so I'll take you through it in three steps. The first thing is to understand the context, what's happening for Jesus as he cries out these words. Jesus is hanging on a cross outside the city of Jerusalem. He'd come before a Roman official, and though he'd been found not guilty, he was condemned to die anyway. And the Romans had actually perfected the art of killing someone as painfully and as slowly as possible by crucifixion. the person nailed to the cross would drift between suffocation as their chest cavity would collapse and searing pain as they would then push themselves up on their nailed limbs. Sometimes it would take the person on the cross days to die. Notice, however, that as gory as the sight of crucifixion would have been, they're not the details that we get here. Verse 35, we read, "When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots." It only gets the first part of the sentence, "when they had crucified him." There's actually other details in view here, which is a hint to us that there's something more horrifying than nailed flesh taking place here. With Jesus' lungs short of air and his tongue sticking to the roof of his mouth, he chooses his dying words carefully. But significantly, Jesus' last words are the very first words of a psalm written 1,000 years earlier by the king of Israel at the time, King David. Now, a psalm is a piece of poetry that reflected the experiences of real people in real places in a real moment in history. And this poetry was then put to music. And so we read in Psalm 22, which is also printed on your sheet, 1,000 years before Jesus, we read that psalm open up with, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer, by night, and am not silent." Now, being a king in the Middle East in ancient times was pretty much what it's like to be a king right today in the Middle East. Hard. David faced political and military and religious opposition. And we actually know a whole bunch about his life and know that he suffered greatly, personally. But notice David's greatest fear in this psalm. It isn't his sickness or his politics. It's his fear that God has forsaken him. Now, to be forsaken isn't just to be lonely. It's actually to be abandoned by someone who is precious. And so David's greatest fear, despite what's going on around him, is that he is out of relationship with God, that he has a damaged relationship with God. And therefore, because of that greatest fear, his greatest hope is God would hear him, God would be near to him, that his relationship would be restored with God. And so let me pause just right there and ask you, how does that fear relate to your greatest fear? What is the greatest fear that you have? Because it's out of our fears that we find our hope, that we look for our hope. And so as we read the psalm, as it carries on, we find that David uses poetry to describe the horror of his situation. But horror that clearly points beyond his own situation, his own circumstance. Have a look with me closely. We see there in verse 6 and 7 that he's out in public being despised and mocked, insulted. People are shaking their heads at him. Verse 14, his bones are out of joint. Verse 15, he's dying of thirst. 17, he's in such bad shape that his bones are poking out of his body. Verse 16, he has been pierced in his hands and feet. Now, what's going on here? What's happening to him? This is a description of execution by crucifixion. Verse 18, we see that men are gambling for his clothes. This was the practice of ancient times where the executioner would gamble, would keep the criminal's clothing. Here's the thing though, crucifixion wasn't around in the time of David. This is something that was developed after him. So what's David talking about here? What's happening? Well, he's using poetic license to write of experiences that reflect his own in part, but won't fully come to pass until another 1,000 years when Jesus comes. And Jesus, we find out, is actually a great-great-great-great-grandson of David, who 14 generations later finds himself out in public being mocked, despised and spat at. His hands and feet nailed to a cross, his clothes being divided by his executioners, and crying out, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Just as a tiny little aside, if you've ever thought the Bible is myth and legend and make-believe, man, I'd plead with you to look at this kind of stuff. A document written 1,000 years prior to Jesus, fulfilled to the detail as Jesus comes and heads to his death. Second thing, what does it mean that Jesus was God forsaken? Well, whatever it means, we see that it is Jesus' greatest fear, the source of his unmatched pain. See, like David, Jesus' greatest fear wasn't his physical pain. We don't hear him go, my hands, my feet." It's not that he's dying at the ripe age of 33, having never married and had kids, having never travelled and experienced other cultures, having never owning his own home and renovating it and glorying in it. That's not what we hear him cry out. We hear him cry out of his God-forsakenness. Like David, Jesus' greatest fear was abandonment by God, a damaged relationship with God. But there's also a profound difference between these words on Jesus' lips and David's lips. See, when you keep reading Psalm 22, you find that David felt God forsaken, but actually that's all it was, a feeling. We find that David was not actually abandoned by God. But unlike David, we find that Jesus really was God forsaken. Now that won't strike you as staggering until you come to see Jesus for who he is. See, the Bible claims that Jesus is God's eternal Son with no beginning, who existed from eternity past with his Father, in perfect, unending, intimate, joyous relationship. So close was their relationship that Jesus could say that his words were God's words. That to actually look at Jesus was to see God. That he and the Father were one. Yet, on the cross, something in the very fabric of this relationship is torn. And we hear the horror of that separation in his cry. Why would God do this to his own Son, his perfect Son? The answer the Bible gives: to offer you hope, solid hope. See, we hope for all sorts of things because we fear loneliness and sickness and boredom. But Jesus says that our greatest fear ought to be our separation from God, that if not healed, would lead to a hopeless eternity. But why would God abandon us? Why would he do that? Well, it's because we've abandoned him. We've sinned, which is to have lived with ourselves at the center of the universe, which is to have set ourselves up on our own throne as our own king to live about whatever we want to live about, our own purposes, our own plans, our own pleasures. That, at its essence, is what the Bible calls sin, a rejection of God as God, a running from him to be our own king. And though we convince ourselves that we're doing pretty well, thank you very much, we're like the flower in a vase that is slowly dying. We're like the laptop that's running out of battery. We've cut ourselves off from the very source of life itself. But not only does our sin act like a knife in cutting us off from God, it also acts as a barrier preventing us from coming back to God. We have no hope of turning and coming back to Him. Do you know that the debt problem in our country is so serious for so many people that some will never, ever, ever get out of debt based on the average income that we make? Our mortgages, our cars, our credit cards are so great, many Australians will live under debt forever. And you know, Jesus actually uses the imagery of currency and debt himself to describe our problem with God. And he says that the debt of our sin is so great that we have no hope of ever repaying it and being free from it. No amount of trying harder, no amount of doing better can make right what our sin against God has made wrong. And you know, this actually comes as a massive surprise to many people in our community. I saw that our recent census, the stats show that 70% of the Central Coast associate themselves with the God of this Bible. And as I talk to many of these people, it's clear that there's a belief of, well, all right, me and God might not be really tight, but there's no reason to be angry with me. What are you talking about? I'm just fine with him, thank you very much, and I'm headed towards his heaven. And when I ask, what makes you so confident about that? The responses I hear are like, I'm a good person, yeah? My good deeds outweigh my bad deeds. I haven't killed anyone. I was born in Australia. I'm not a Muslim. All these kind of thoughts that we tell ourselves make ourselves okay with God. Jesus says this is a hopeless miscalculation of our situation. That if left in, leaves us destined for a hopeless eternity. But friends, here comes the hope. Here's the hope. Because thirdly, Jesus was God forsaken for us. Because unlike a bank, God is actually grieved that there's a debt that stands between us and him. And he loves us. And he wants us back in relationship with him. And so he's made a way when there was no other. He has sent his son Jesus into his world, but who, unlike you and me, lived a sinless life, kept God at the center of his universe, who not only didn't have a debt to God, but had a credit to his account of infinite favor from God. And he goes to the cross, which is the reason Jesus said he came, where he willingly takes on the debt of my sin upon himself, where he willingly exchanges in return his perfect standing before God. He credits everything that was in his account to my account. He takes the debt that I had upon himself. And so on the cross, God's just punishment for sin is poured out in full strength on Jesus. Friends, Jesus was God forsaken on the cross so that you don't have to be. His death redefines our greatest fear, to be abandoned by God forever. But it offers our greatest hope to be forgiven and to be restored back into a relationship with God that we were made to be in. There is solid hope in the seemingly hopeless words of Jesus. Now, what I want to do is just take a step back from that and have a look at this solid hope from three different aspects. I want to put to you that Jesus' death rewrites our past, present, and future hopes. So firstly, Jesus rewrites our past hope. The person who puts their trust in Jesus, who accepts his death as their death, has their past rewritten. There's another part of the Bible that says, based on Jesus dying on the cross, if anyone is in Christ, that is, if anyone has come to Jesus and trusted in him, they are a new creation. The old has gone. The new has come. Friends, that is good news for people who face up to their guilt and their shame. I'll tell you why. So often, our past can destroy our hope. The shameful things that we've done to others that we love. Possibly shameful abuses that have been committed against us. We try and run from it. We try and squash the memory of it. But they haunt us. They follow us. And much of the time, they end up defining us. I'm the bloke who did such and such. I'm the girl that did such and such, that had such and such done to me. They box us in. It's as though the guilt and shame of our past reaches into our present and strangles our hope. Can anyone track with that? Can anyone relate with that? That's been my experience. It's been the experience of many people who have spoken to me honestly about what it's been like to come to Jesus. But friends, you got to hear this. If you are a Christian, someone who has traded place with Jesus, all of your shame, all of your guilt has been taken by him on that cross 2,000 years ago. So that your defining moment is no longer that horrible thing that you did. It's no longer the father that you had or didn't have. It's no longer the marks that you never got, the friends that you never had. Your defining moment is Jesus hanging there on a cross for you, crying out of his God-forsakenness for you, because he and his father love you and want to pursue you. And want to cleanse you. Friends, the death of Jesus rewrites your history, rewrites your past hope. Man, that's a liberating reason for hope. Secondly, that spills into this. Jesus rewrites our present hope. The Bible describes one of the outworkings of hope as joy. As joy. See, there's a deep joy of being forgiven, isn't there? You know that horrible conscience that we have that convicts us, that condemns us. You know the beauty of the joy we have when we come to someone who we've wronged and they forgive us. The joy of forgiveness, the joy of our consciences being relieved. And not just the joy of being forgiven, as though our relationship with God has been sterilized, but the joy of an intimate, dynamic relationship as someone who is cherished by God, who is adopted by God as their child. This is the kind of joy that I think Jacinda in that video was referring to. Something that she said she just couldn't see. This is a joy that just affects all of life. And it's not a superficial joy that's at the mercy of our situations, yeah? How am I feeling this week? How much am I weighing today? Who am I dating or not dating this week? It's separate from all of that. Because a Christian continues to hope in things, yeah? But they're no longer ultimate hopes. Because our relationships may break. Our health may fail. We may lose our wealth. But the hope which brings joy is not grounded in them. Friends, if you're on the roller coaster of that life, of up and down, of hopes there and disappearing, of joy all over the show, jump off. Jump off. I rode that roller coaster. It sucks. There is a real, solid, deep-seated joy to be had in Jesus, independent of your situation. And so joy is not at odds with suffering. There is hope. There is real hope. Jesus rewrites our present hope. Thirdly, Jesus rewrites our future hope. You know, I haven't met anyone who doesn't want to change in some kind of way, change part of who they are. We make all sorts of attempts to do this. But the promise of the Bible is that what Jesus has done on the cross is the grounds that guarantee transformation. Solid hope that you do not have to stay the same. But not the kind of transformation that self-help books and lifestyle shows talk about, which focus on the externals and the efforts of our modifying our behaviours. The forgiveness in Jesus enables lasting change from within. And I'm not talking about just a different set of attitudes and beliefs, but the Bible describes it as a whole new heart, a whole new center of you that has a whole new way of looking at life. Your heart beats and desires after things that God does. Your heart starts to hate the things that God does. We start to live the way that we're intended to. Oh, the hope of transformation is epic. The old is gone, the new has come. But you know, where the Bible puts most of its emphasis on the hope to come, the emphasis is on the day that Jesus will come back, when he will return. Christian hope is the confident expectation of facing him that day as your king and as your judge, as the one who will bring every word, every thought, every action that you have ever done to light. Christian hope is being confident to stand that day and to be accepted by Jesus into his heaven on that day, not because of your track record, but because of his merits, because of his efforts for you. You have assurance of the day that you meet God face to face. Christian hope is the confident expectation of living in a completely renewed world, never again to be broken, one that is promised to have no more death, no more mourning, no more pain, no more crying. Friends, it is an epic future hope that the Bible holds out, grounded in the death of Jesus. He rewrites our past, present, and future hopes. But this hope is held out only for the person who would turn from their life of sin, would turn from being the one who sits on their own throne to the one who truly does sit on the throne over the entire universe. It is offered only to the person who would come back to God through Jesus. Friends, this hope requires you to make a decision. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? I'll wrap up. You might be asking, how can I be certain that the things you're talking about are true, that the cross of Jesus really did do what you're saying it did? Well, you know, Psalm 22 of David, when you keep reading it through to the end, it doesn't end in tragedy. It ends in triumph. It doesn't end in despair, but in deliverance. God hears David. God answers him, and he rescues him. And do you know how the eyewitness accounts of Jesus finish? Not with his death and burial. Jesus entrusted himself to the same God who heard David's cry and rescued him. The God who raised Jesus to life, never to die again. Friends, the only reason a cross is to be celebrated is because we look at it through the lens of the resurrection, the event that we celebrate in 2 days' time, that a dead man really did come back to life in history, never to die again. All of the hope in Jesus hangs on this truth in reality. And so I want to encourage you, if you're still unsure about that, press into that. You might come back on Sunday. You might go to Life that you heard spoken about. We've got some books and some resources at the table up the back that you might want to grab. We're going to have some people hanging around the front if you want to come and ask questions about any of this kind of stuff. But friends, the offer is so great. So great. Can I plead with you to investigate it? And if you have, and if you've put your trust in this Jesus, in his death, come back Sunday and would you celebrate the hope we have in him, the certainty of everything he has promised us. Let me pray. Father, thank you that you are a God who has made yourself known, that we don't have to guess, we don't have to gamble, but you have made yourself known in history, in Jesus. We thank you that his words are your words, that we see his character, we see who you are, and we see that you're a God who loves us, who has pursued us, who wants us back in relationship with yourself. And so we thank you for the lengths that you went to with the death of your own perfect son, Jesus. Father, we do not deserve that, but we thank you for it. We thank you that you are a God who does not lie. We thank you that we can have certain confidence in your promises, the promises of a transformed life in Jesus, the promises of our past no longer held against us, no longer hanging over us, and the promise of a future hope so good we can hardly imagine. Father, help us to take Jesus' words seriously. Help us to take great hope in him, a hope that will never end, a hope that will never die. In his name we ask. Amen.